The Bulletin on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Cheryl Reed. She's got a new novel out. It's called Poison Girls. She joins us by telephone from Syracuse, New York. Welcome to the program, Cheryl.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Vic. I appreciate it.
Cheryl, is this your first book?
No, it's my first novel, but it's...
Okay.
My first book came out in 2004 and reprinted in 2010. It was called Unveil the Hidden Lives of Nuns, and it was nonfiction.
Oh, that's right. I remember seeing something about that, The Hidden Life of Nuns.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. That's quite
it was quite
a different book.
It was an adventure.
well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's talk about Poison Girls. How did you get the idea for this novel?
Well, part of it was that it's based on two true stories, one of which happened while I was a reporter at the Dayton Daily News in Dayton, Ohio. And I had sort of retained that, and I'd gone through a couple of writing programs, and everyone kept saying, oh, you need to write that story. You need to write that story. It's an incredible story. And at first, I was just too close to it, and I wasn't interested in revisiting that story. It was very painful for me. And so it was sometime later, it was about 10 years later, that I decided, after Unveiled had come out, I decided it was time for me to revisit that sort of painful place. And so I started writing the book. And at the same time, in Chicago, I was an editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, there was this heroin epidemic happening where 250 people were killed by one bad batch of fentanyl-laced heroin sold by one drug dealer, one gang member. And Illinois at that time went after this guy and charged him with murder. And it was the first time ever in the state that they had charged a drug dealer with murder for killing his victims. So I started looking at the victims then, and there were a lot of white suburban girls who were, you know, not what you would think of as your typical victim, you know, cheerleading squad, soccer team captain, studying for their SATs, that sort of stuff. And they resembled a lot of the girls that I had previously hung out with who were secretly doing crack cocaine 10 years earlier. And I saw the similarities, and I thought, this is how I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to tell the story that I know really well, and I'm going to update it by 10 years and deal with the heroin crisis. So it's sort of a story that happened in two different decades that I sewed together with the magic of fiction.
Therefore, when you were reporting for the Dayton Daily News, that was during the, quote, crack epidemic?
Yes, yes.
What years were you at Dayton?
So I was at Dayton 91 to 96. And in the summer of 1994, we had done a series called Kids in Chaos, and we did several different stories that were dealing basically with what kids were secretly doing. And one of the things that I was looking at was young white girls who were involved in dangerous drugs, including crack cocaine. And at the time, I asked the police knew what I was doing, but I asked the police, you know, what about white girls doing crack cocaine? What can you tell me about that? And they were like, well, that doesn't happen. I was like, well, I know it happens. And so, in essence, I was trying to go out and, you know, debunk the myth that white girls don't do crack. I mean, it was pretty easy to do. But during that time that I was hanging out with these girls, they were engaged in a lot of different drugs. It wasn't just crack. And it was whatever they could get their hands on. And so sometime later, I had stopped following them for about 6 weeks. One of the girls, Michelle Lay, and her sister and her cousin, they were all out in a car, and they got trying to score some more crack. and they got lost in a bad neighborhood. Their car was encircled with these girls who were taunting them, and one shot Michelle in the face. And so the uncle of Michelle, who knew me, her family knew me, called me and told me this. And, you know, I was a crime reporter, so I had to, you know, immediately go and write the story. You know, I was kind of in shock and mourning and just, it's kind of weird to have someone that you, you know, briefly was pretty close to and sort of knew their personal lives. And then the next minute they're involved in a tragic death. And so I interviewed her mother. I did all these things on deadline. And my editors at the paper said, you know, this is an amazing story. You need to write it in first person. So I wrote it in first person, and it was pretty gritty. You know, it admitted that I saw her doing drugs, and you know that I sort of chronicled her descent into more serious drugs. And so the next day when it came out, the judge who was arraigning her killers said that I and the paper had blood on our hands, and he initiated a police investigation. So, I mean, I was a crime reporter. I'd written a lot of stories about the police. Police were not, I wasn't exactly high on their list of heroes, you know. And they were all too happy to comply. I'll say that. And it just kept, you know, it kept going and kept going. So there was this cloud over me that there was this, you know, really silly investigation. But they wanted to try to connect me that I had somehow, their working theory was that I was so absorbed and so concerned about furthering my career as a journalist that I would actually supply girls with crack cocaine in order to tell a story. Because girls weren't really doing crack cocaine, I had to get them to do it. It was just silliness. But if convicted, I would have gone to prison for 12 years. It was a mandatory prison sentence. So it was pretty scary stuff, and stuff that, you know, I was 28 years old. I was kind of freaking out. And my editors at the time supplied me with the newspaper editor who was like, I know First Amendment rights. I don't know criminal stuff. So, you know, and thank God I had a next door neighbor who was a criminal attorney who, you know, basically took my case and really helped me. And, you know, it was a harrowing time. I ended up having to take a polygraph. And after I took the polygraph examiner said, you know, you passed, duh. And by the way, I did all the polygraphs and all of her killers and everybody was in that car, and you were in no way responsible for her death. And, you know, by the way, she was doing crack long before you ever showed up. So even though she sort of lied to me and told me that this was her first experiences. So it was a really scary, scary time, and I think kind of unique. I don't know that a lot of people have gone through this sort of experience, thankfully. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And so that was sort of, the background of what happened to me in Dayton.
In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Book Nook. My guest is Cheryl Reed, and she has a novel out called Poison Girls, which I finished reading last night, Cheryl, and listening to you talk about your experiences at the Dayton Daily News, I can't believe how autobiographical this novel is.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yes and no. I mean, it's interesting. I am currently writing a piece for Columbia Journalism Review and talking about taking news to the novel. And one of the things that I'm writing about is, yes, a lot of the stuff is true. Yes, it is based on truth. But you don't remember every little detail. And you know, as fiction, you don't remember what somebody was wearing. You don't remember dialogue per se. You kind of vaguely remember certain things. You might remember a single sentence. I couldn't have in good conscience written this as a memoir. It really is, you know, the mortar of the book is, you know, stolen pieces of memory and fantasy and imagination. I mean, Natalie is a version of myself. She's not me. And I think that's really important to note. I'm nowhere near as brave as she is. And I don't have comebacks as good as she does. And I think that, you know, fiction allows you the opportunity to tell a story, not just a snapshot in time, which journalism does, but to tell the story with a narrative arc and to supply motivations that you normally don't have access to as a journalist.
You are listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And I'll continue my conversation with Cheryl Reed right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm joined on the program today by Cheryl Reed. Her book, Poison Girls, just came out. It's a novel. And we were talking before the break about your experiences that inspired some of this story. And your story is set in Chicago. And you mentioned a moment ago your protagonist, who is a crime reporter for a paper called the Chicago Times. Her name is Natalie Delaney. You said that she's a lot braver than you were as a reporter. Tell us about Natalie Delaney. Who is she?
She's a street smart reporter, but she's also a little bit naive. In the book, she's a product of growing up in Hyde Park, which is in Chicago, but it's on the south side, but it's also where the University of Chicago is. So it's this really interesting enclave of half white, half black, really well-educated, hippie kind of Birkenstock kind of, you know, little Berkeley there, and also really smart people. In the book, I talk about how, which is true, there are more Nobel Prize winners in 1 mile radius in Chicago than anywhere else in the world. And it's a really unique place. And so in the book, her parents are university professors. She's grown up in this really protected enclave. Another fact, which is true, is that the University of Chicago has the largest private police force in the United States. So it's a small neighborhood that's surrounded by bad neighborhoods. And so she grew up there pretty much protected and was always curious about the other side, you know, as I say in the book, the red zone. And so she becomes this crime reporter, and she's competing with, you know, she's a young girl, young female crime reporter, and her editors are these, which really was true in a lot of times in my case, sort of these macho, paternalistic news editors who do not want to send out a female crime reporter in the middle of the night to a bad neighborhood. So they send her to, like, go hold the victim's hands, go talk to the parents, that sort of thing. And she never really gets the big story. So, and it's set during 2008 when a certain senator from Hyde Park was running for president and the city was vying for the 2016 Olympics. So, you know, Chicago was on the world stage, and yet all these fentanyl deaths were happening. And at the same time, the newspaper industry is falling apart, and the Chicago Times is having all these layoffs, which really happened during that time. And Natalie feels that her only chance to keep her job is if she gets a big break, if she gets a big story, and it's not going to be because somebody assigned it to her. It's going to be because she finds it.
The atmosphere at the newspaper isn't very collegial, at least in your story.
You know, I've worked in 6 or 7 newsrooms, and, you know, there's a certain amount of professional competition. And I would say the Chicago Sun-Times was fairly competitive, and I would say the Dayton Daily News when I worked there was pretty competitive. I think that part is pretty genuine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Poison Girls. Let's talk about who they are or were without doing any spoilers. I think we can get the skeleton in this at least. We don't have to fill out the flesh on the story, but the skeleton's there.
Okay.
Who are the Poison Girls?
So the Poison Girls are these girls who are largely from very prominent families in Chicago. And Chicago is a very political town, and there are stronghold Democratic families, meaning these certain kinds of wealthy Democratic powerhouse families are what control the politics in Chicago. And so what starts to happen is that the police start to see a pattern that the girls who were, you know, a lot of people are dying of phenyl-laced heroin. Some of these people are, a lot of them are suburban kids. And of the suburban kids, a lot of them are daughters of these very wealthy Democratic families. And so the theory is that somebody's trying to knock off these girls from these prominent families, and they can't figure out why. You know, why is this happening? Is this a serial killer? Who's doing this? How do these girls have access? Most of them live on the North Shore, which is on the north side of Chicago, and most of the deaths are occurring by drug dealers or being sold on the south side. You know, that's like an hour drive distance. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of all this, you have a guy who is a Kennedy-like person, Scion from a Kennedy-like family, who is caught with naloxone, with Narcan, so in his car with needles. So another wealthy, you know, teen who is running around with an antidote to heroin. So it's, you know, you have this sort of secret world that's going on that people can't access, and you don't know what's happening. So those are the poison girls.
Mm-hmm.
And poison, by the way, is a street name for fentanyl-laced heroin.
Okay. My father grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I can remember going there to visit his parents, and it was a pretty sketchy neighborhood, pretty bad neighborhood even back in those days. And I can remember being afraid of the police, being afraid of the Chicago police. There was something very intimidating about them. And mm-hmm. in your story, we clearly get the impression that the police can be kind of scary. And she, your reporter, has this informant who is a police officer, and he's a fascinating character. I really liked him. Did you know someone like him?
Mo is based on, yes. Mo is based on a real character. Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I like him because he's like this cool black dude, and he knows, he's not going to take Natalie's BS, and he cuts right through it. And he challenges her on a lot of issues, which I think I like the dynamic there between them.
I also think of Chicago as being a very corrupt city, corrupt politicians, mm-hmm. Corruption in the police. I have a good friend in Chicago who I visit now and then, and he's pretty well connected. And on his dashboard, he keeps a little business card, and it says, "One get out of jail free card," and it has the Chicago police stamp on it, and it's a real card.
Well, in answer to your question, yes, the police in Chicago are very corrupt. It is a corrupt city, and a lot of it's based on who you know, and having a card that's got a stamp of an official stamp of the Chicago police, yeah, that would get you out, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Well, he just has a business card. I guess if he ever gets in trouble, he just presents it, and they go, okay, see you later.
Yeah, it's also, so if you are illegally parked, if you have the headband of a police officer's hat, you will not get ticketed.
Okay. Well, he parks illegally all the time, so I guess that says it. My guest is Cheryl Reed. Her book is Poison Girls. Can we talk about the beginning of the story? I think we really need to kind of set the scene. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, tell us what's happening at the beginning as this story opens.
So the story opens that there have been several deaths, fentanyl-laced heroin deaths, and Natalie is at the house in Chinatown, which is on the near south side of Chicago, and there's it's basically a shooting gallery, and they've found three girls who are dead. And of overdoses. And these are girls from prominent suburban families. And they attend the Queen of Angels Academy. It's a girls' school, Catholic girls' school on the north side. It doesn't exist anymore, but that's the school. And so in the book, they're from the Queen of Angels Academy, and their bodies have been found, and they literally went to this shooting gallery right after the last day of school. So it's June 13th, 2008. They find the bodies 3 days after the girls have overdosed. And Natalie is standing outside the house, and she sees these two girls walking by. And these, and mind you, this is on the south side, it's Chinatown. There aren't a lot of teenage girls walking around. And these two girls walk by. One of them looks almost exactly like Natalie. She has red hair and freckles and green eyes. And for a moment, she's struck with, you know, the doppelganger kind of overwhelming feeling of, you know, who is this person? I need to know who she is. And she ends up running after these girls and connecting with these girls in a way that they tell her that they know why these girls are doing fentanyl-laced heroin, why they're doing poison. But they're taunting her and not willing to give up much information, which is really what happens on the street when you're doing street reporting. A lot of times people will insist that they might know something, but they're trying to feel you out. And so Natalie feels like these girls probably do know what they're talking about, and they probably are into heroin, and she wants to hang out with them. And when she talks, she goes back to the newspaper, and she tells her editor what's happened, and her editor says, absolutely, you know, go for it. And so she really sees this as her one opportunity to snag a really big story and break a story that's huge in the midst of this heroin epidemic, because if there are a lot of these girls, they're probably not going to talk to a middle-aged guy, and they're probably not going to, like, you know, have a middle-aged reporter kind of hanging around them. That's kind of creepy. But they might allow a young female reporter to hang out with them if she's cool enough or she presents herself as cool enough. So that's her challenge, is to, you know, ingratiate herself into this secret world of these girls. And so that's what's happened.
Natalie is hungry for the big story, and so is her editor. And this creates problems throughout the book, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So the editor is based on, you know, it's a combination of lots of editors I've had. But, you know, this editor has upward ambitions. And I say in the book, that's always dangerous in the journalism world because, you know, the bottom line and good journalism don't always mix. And so she keeps seeing, her editor, Amy, keeps seeing that whatever Natalie can dig up, she's going to benefit. And so she's egging her on instead of saying, pulling her back and saying, hey, maybe this is too dangerous, maybe this is too risky, which is really what a good editor should have been doing.
Was this the same period? I seem to recall that one of the big Chicago papers was about to be sold during this period. Wasn't that accurate? You have this going on with your newspaper in your fiction.
Yes. So the newspaper in Poison Girls is a combination of the Chicago Sun-Times, where I worked, and also the Chicago Tribune, where my husband worked. And it's mostly based on the Tribune, but the interior of the newsroom is really my experience at the Sun-Times, because the Sun-Times, we were, you know, the underdog, and the newsroom was a little feistier, and people were punchier. And I mean, there was a lot of stuff that happened in that newsroom that I'd never seen happen in any other newsroom. And it would be really interesting when I would go over to the Tribune, where I had lots of friends and my husband, it would be like the insurance office. No one spoke. People had their headsets on. It was a completely different, you know, climate.
The Sun-Times was more of a brawling atmosphere.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wow.
So, and it is actually at the time, both newspapers were for sale. Both newspapers are going through bankruptcy. But I mean, you know, all of the stuff that was happening in the book is really, really happened and is currently happening. Chicago Tribune reporters are now moving out of that building. The building's been sold, and now they're going to make it into condos, just like in the book.
Well, it's a tough time to be in the newspaper business. You know this better than anybody, huh?
Yeah, well, it is a tough time, yeah.
Yeah, because as you say early on in the book, why would you want to buy a newspaper when you can get that stuff for free on the internet? Or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think now, especially in the last year, Certainly the New York Times and the Washington Post and some of the bigger papers have seen a resurgence in subscriptions and support. But, you know, certainly in 2007 and 2008, I will say those were the dark days because we really felt that the rug was pulled out underneath us and we had given away everything because for so long you could go on to any newspaper site pretty much, except for maybe the Wall Street Journal, and get everything you needed for free. So, you know, a lot of us in the newsroom were always questioning this model. But that's what we were doing because we were told that this is what we had to do to become competitive. And in the end, that sort of undercut us because then people expected it to be free and they wouldn't pay for it. So, you know, obviously the newer model is to pay for your subscriptions. And I think, you know, we're returning to a better climate in terms of people understanding that it's important to know who you're getting your news from. And so but certainly in 2008, that wasn't the case.
By the time some newspapers got around to putting up paywalls, the cows were already out in the pasture. I have to think that one reason there's been a resurgence, particularly for online subscriptions, is our new president. I think that this has created a lot more interest in reading the newspaper.
It's also created more interest in people going back to journalism school. I have no idea why, but we have at Syracuse, the Newhouse School of Communications, we have one of the largest classes this year.
Really?
It's been just an amazing amount of interest in journalism.
That's encouraging.
It is encouraging. I'm kind of astounded that people are paying, you know, $50,000 a year in tuition for a job that's probably going to pay a lot less than that per year.
Well, I think journalism, it's kind of like being a librarian. You've got to be passionate about the work. You're not doing it to get rich.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
My guest is Cheryl Reed. Her novel is Poison Girls. On the cover, we have a photo of a woman, and her throat has a butterfly tattoo on it. And as we read the story and we find out who this woman is, this you've got some dark, dark plot lines going on in this thing. I mean, I read it and I was like, whoa, how'd you come up with this?
Well, you know, I was a crime reporter and I did see a lot of the dark side of life. And I think a lot of reporters have good material in their notebooks that would make, you know, any good thriller. The secret is just and the hard work is to make all that come alive and put in a suspenseful story that hopefully people will read and, you know, 400 pages and feel satisfied at the end.
It seems that being a crime reporter and being a journalist is a good preparation for becoming a novelist. We look at people like Michael Connelly, John Sanford. They had long careers as journalists before they became novelists, and it seems to work out pretty well sometimes.
I think it works out sometimes. I think it's really – it was hard for me to make the transition somewhat. One, I didn't have a lot of confidence that I could write fiction, which I should have had more confidence, but I knew how to be a good reporter and I had confidence as a reporter, but I think, you know, in the literary world, so I got my MFA at Northwestern and I went to a lot of literary conferences. And I mean, at first when I was writing, I didn't really know what I was writing. I just knew that I had the story I wanted to write. And you know, people really look down on crime stories and thrillers. So, oh, that's a genre. And so I didn't want to write genre. I was afraid of writing genre. I had an MFA. I was supposed to be writing, you know, literature or whatever. And, you know, then at some point I just realized, you know, this is what I'm writing. This is a story I'm writing, and whatever you want to call it, it is what it is. And I think you have to, you know, I had to get over that hang up.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined on the program by Cheryl Reed. Her novel is Poison Girls, and we'll have one more segment of The Book Nook coming up right after this. It's The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Cheryl Reed, and her first novel came out recently. It's called Poison Girls. She joins us by telephone from Syracuse, New York. When we started the program, I asked you, this is your first book, and you said, no, I had another book, but it was nonfiction. It was a book about nuns. Tell us about the nuns and this project.
When I left the Dayton Daily News, I went to Ohio State on a year-long program that was called the Kiplinger Program. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's for mid-career journalists. And you work on an investigative project the entire year. So I wanted to work on something that was really compelling, and I chose to do a year-long investigation on secretly married priests. I wasn't Catholic. I didn't know anything about, you know, religion per se in that way, or Catholicism or theology. This is something I decided I wanted to do. And I did do it. I did a year-long project. It was published in Mother Jones. And then after that, I decided, well, you know, I want to take a look at the nuns. Why not, you know, what are the issues with the nuns? I mean, I had already done priests, so I wanted to do nuns. So I started to, I got a grant from the Alicia Patterson Foundation to write four magazine pieces. And I started to to visit these nuns and live with them. And, I mean, I was frankly terrified of them. I you know, the whole habit was really spooky to me, and I didn't understand it. And, you know, it was like The Exorcist or something. I mean, it was really difficult for me to understand. So that's why I wanted to do it, of course. And I spent all this time with these cloistered nuns who were really hip and out and protesting the war and, you know, marrying people who were gay. And I mean, it was like this, you know, incredible dichotomy. Huh. I mean, I went to convents where people, and several convents where women were behind bars, and they were cloistered, and it was for one particular order, it was during the summer, and they'd given up eating all vegetables.
Really?
You know, as penance. And, you know, I mean, this is like this really interesting culture, subculture I knew nothing about. And I started working on this, and I started interviewing people. And, you know, as a reporter, you kind of know when you've come to the end of the story, because you'll interview someone and then they'll say something similar to the last person, or, you know, and you sort of feel like, okay, I got the story. But I was into this story for 2 years, traveling around the world, really. I went to Russia and Moscow, and then also in Canada. I chose not to use those people, so I just used the United States. But I visited and interviewed over 300 nuns, and I was kind of obsessed with it. I was like, this is like this phenomenal world nobody knows about, and all these women are dying. And, I mean, the average age is 70-something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there aren't a lot of women running to become nuns now. So, and I was also fascinated with that. Like, why would you give up money, sex, and men? You know, what motivates a woman to do this? So, I mean, I was just all these questions. And, you know, luckily I was able to, again, ingratiate myself to these different women. And they opened up to me and told me their stories. And so that is why it's called The Hidden Lives of Nuns, because there actually is a whole theology behind the hidden life of the nuns. And so that's what I was unveiling, was what that was all about. And so it's about curiosity, I suppose, you know, allowing your job to make you fulfill your curiosity.
Were any of these nuns Dominicans?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You didn't go up to Adrian, Michigan, did you?
No, but I know about them. I visited some of their sisters in other places. Yeah.
Yeah, I went to a parochial school with Dominican nuns, and I loved them. They were from Adrian.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were wonderful.
Wow.
What's this about priests who are married secretly? I'm not familiar with this.
So I didn't really want to do pedophile priests. That really wasn't what I was interested in. What I was interested in was really the combination of somebody, and literally I thought this through. This was not like, oh, I want to do secretly married priests. I thought, I want to interview someone. I want to do a project on someone who literally their passion in life conflicts with the love of their life. Hmm. So, like, who would this be? And I would draw this intersection, like, well, what, you know, it could be a variety of people. But then I came up with priests. You know, if you're in love, you can't, you're supposed to be celibate. You can't be married. And then I found out there was this whole world of some of them are former priests who got married, and then there are some who are current priests who are secretly married. And I found documents of the Catholic Church paying, support for child support for priests who had had children, and you know all this sort of stuff. And so there was this sort of secret world of priests who had relationships and love lives and children.
And so many secrets.
I'm sorry?
So many secrets.
So many secrets, yeah.
Wow. Looking at your bio here that you have taught in the Ukraine, there's got to be a story there.
So, yes, I just got back from the Ukraine in July. I had a Fulbright scholarship, and I taught at the largest university in Ukraine, in Kiev, their graduate journalism program. And so I taught them investigative journalism and immersion journalism for a year. During that time, I also did some research on investigative reporting in Ukraine. And so I'm actually going back, and we're probably going to start taking students to Ukraine from Syracuse.
An exchange program of some sort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to teach investigative and data-based journalism both to on two different continents at the same time. I don't know how that's going to work, but that's our goal.
Do you speak Ukrainian?
I took lessons while I was there, and then I learned that in Kiev, which is in the, you know, it's in the eastern part of the state, of the country, they mostly speak Russian.
Uh-huh.
So I took a little bit of Ukrainian, a little bit of Russian. I would really like to take more Russian.
Hmm. Yeah, that's probably helpful.
It is helpful, but, you know, almost all young people speak English.
Really?
If you get lost in Ukraine, ask a young person because they'll speak English.
Hmm.
It's unofficially their second language, although Russian is really their second language. I taught in English. A lot of the universities, you're required to be able to, you have to take an English level exam in order to get in. So, you know, they're really trying to be more Western.
Is there someone as you're teaching who then translates it into Russian?
No, I teach in English.
Okay, so the students mostly understand it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting to know that because here in the U.S., most people don't speak a second language.
I know.
You know,
it's tragic.
It's amazing. My guest is Cheryl Reed, and her book is Poison Girls. Let's go back to the story. This is kind of a love story in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. You mean a love story of Chicago?
Well, I don't know about that, but she, your reporter, she kind of has a little bit of love for some men in the story.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, she's really attracted to the bad guys. I mean, she's conflicted because she is very attracted to this Danny character who is the uncle of one of the girls. And he's sort of, you know, this polite guy, but, you know, he works in a factory. She doesn't even know if he has a high school education. He's from Indiana. He speaks, you know, with a twang. I mean, it's not the guy that she would think that she would normally be bringing home to her parents, you know. And also there's the issue that, you know, really she shouldn't be involved with somebody who she's covering or the relatives of somebody who she's covering. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's ethical qualms that she's having. But she's very attracted to him. She doesn't really understand that. And part of it is that he reminds her in some way of this boyfriend that she had who was a heroin addict. And part of her attraction or her lust to understand why these girls are doing heroin is because she has unfinished business with this boyfriend who was a heroin addict.
Hmm. So many layers in this story. And I would suggest that for potential readers of Poison Girls, they will want to read this story to meet your character, Anna, What a beautiful, tragic woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She is based a lot on Michelle, who I dedicated the book to. For your readers in the Dayton area, they may know her as Michelle Lay. And so I dedicated the book to Michelle. She was the young girl who was tragically shot and who I became close to for a very short period of time. And almost all of the scenes in the book were genuine, really happened, dealing with Michelle. Now, a lot of stuff I made up because it is fiction, you know, and when my mother read the book, there is a scene, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a scene where something horrible happens to Natalie, and my mother called up and said, "Oh my God, did that really happen to you?" And uh-huh. I said, you know, it's fiction, Mom.
Uh-huh. So it really did happen, right?
Well, partly.
Right. Okay. Well, your mother isn't listening right now, so.
Hopefully not.
So you're okay. I think it's really a great debut for you in fiction. I think you did a very nice job on this story.
Well, thank you.
The book is Poison Girl. Cheryl Reed wrote it. Is there more fiction in the future for you?
Well, my publisher really wanted me to write a sequel, and my publisher really likes my character. So I do have another book that I'm working on, and this one is, again, I like to pull things from the headlines. You know, I'm a journalist. So this one deals with a white woman shooting a black man in Chicago. And many of the same characters. So there's Natalie, there's Mo, and it's really an intense story about Natalie and Mo. So if you like those two characters, they come up again in a big way.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier that when you were working in Chicago, you were a reporter at the Sun-Times and that your husband was working at the Chicago Tribune. Mm-hmm. Now you are a professor at Syracuse teaching journalism. Is your husband out of journalism? What's he up to?
He took a buyout from the Tribune, offered a buyout. I think it was December 2015. So he's been out about a year. He's working on tracing his roots. When we were in Ukraine, he was able to track down relatives in Ukraine and Belarus, and who no one has been able in his family to trace back for 100 years. So he's writing a book about a little bit about the history, and then also about his connection with Ukraine and Belarus.
Strakarchuk, is that how you pronounce his
Strakarchuk,
name?
Strakarchuk, yes.
And that's Ukrainian?
It is Ukrainian.
Uh-huh. So that's your connection.
Actually, it wasn't. You know, when I applied for the Fulbright, I was supposed to. There are three Fulbrights dedicated to journalists. One is in Africa, one is in Ukraine, and one is in Japan. And I just happened to pick Ukraine, and it was the strongest one for investigative reporting, which is what I wanted to teach. I had also covered, as a journalist, very early in my career, the fall of the wall, and so I was. That history is very dear to me, so I really wanted to go back. And my husband had never been to Ukraine and had never been able to trace back any of his relatives. And while we were there, we were able to find them, and it was a pretty incredible story. I mean, some of it's been written about by various newspapers, but. So he's working on that. And Syracuse keeps trying to possibly get him to teach business journalism. So we'll see what happens.
Cheryl, as you look back at your career as a reporter, is there one story that you did somewhere along the line that you think of as the best story, the most important story, the funnest story? Is there one that you have feelings about?
Well, I think there are a couple stories that I did while I was in Dayton. There are important stories that I did as an investigative journalist that I did in Chicago. And I did a lot of street reporting while I was in Dayton. And the important story that I did in Chicago was I did a year-long investigation on veterans who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who had severe disabilities and who the state of Illinois for injuries we're getting the least amount of disability payments in the country. And this was a huge, huge debacle. And at the time, Senator Obama got involved and Durbin and all of those people, and there were hearings. And I got many, many, my stories, every time I ran a story on some guy who was not getting his disability payments, he then got his disability payments. And, you know, it was a very moving story. And I remember walking into one of the hearings, and all of the men in the room stood up and clapped for me, which was, you know, overwhelming.
Wow.
So, you know, those are the meaningful stories. You know, the stories like this, like the story of Michelle, it was it impacted me. You know, I was a really young journalist. I was trying to do, doing street reporting and trying to be an ethical journalist and getting caught in all kinds of quagmire and blurred lines because they don't teach you that stuff in journalism school, and they don't teach you how to handle that situation in the newsroom. And, you know, when someone that you know and you've covered dies and dies tragically, particularly someone who was 15 years old, and then for political reasons you're publicly blamed for that person's death, that's incredibly impactful. So that story rode with me and rode in my conscience for a long, long time. And I use that story when I'm teaching because I talk about, you know, I talk about the dangers of street reporting and that you need to really know what you're doing and have support and, you know, and have an emergency plan if something happens and know what the ethics are. You have to be very, very clear about that.
That experience sounds like an absolute nightmare. I can see how it would stick with you.
Well, if you had to take a polygraph, which I did, and that was at my attorney said, you know, look, we could just make this all go away. Just take the polygraph, which, you know, is harrowing because, you know, journalists don't take polygraphs. And, you know, here I am taking a polygraph. I don't know anything about them. All I know is that I feel a tremendous amount of guilt, as anybody would. And I'm scared to death and nervous. And, you know, and in the book, as in real life, I went in and the polygraph examiner said, okay, we're going to set a baseline and I'm going to have you lie. And then I lied. And he looked at the graph paper and said, you're a terrible liar. Which made me think, okay, hopefully that means that you're going to be able to tell that I'm telling the truth.
Wow. Well, it's ripped from the headlines. The book is Poison Girls. It's the debut novel by Cheryl Reed. Cheryl, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Vic. It's been a great conversation.
Cheryl Reed knows about ripping fiction from the headlines. In fact, by a very strange coincidence, right after we recorded that interview, it was announced that one of the women who had been implicated in the murder of Michelle Lay in Dayton, that she talked about in the interview, had been released from prison on Christmas Day. And this particular woman was with a group of girls, including LaShawna Keeney, when they got into a verbal altercation with Lay and her friends, according to the Dayton Daily News. The altercation escalated and ended when Keeney apparently shot Lay in the head. And at the time, the girls were out roguing or stealing from garages, according to court records. Lay and a group of girls were sitting in a Chevy Chevette in an alley near Smithville Road when they made contact with Lay's killer, according to an investigation by the Dayton Daily News. And this young woman who has been in prison all this time was just released on Christmas Day. So very much back in the news, this story. And Poison Girls by Cheryl Reed is dedicated to Michelle, who is Michelle Lay, who inspired in some part her novel about girls overdosing in Chicago, rich girls doing heroin. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunes.